So I'm here in the studio with Canahus Emmanuel. So to begin, we're going to be talking about a lot of different issues today, but mainly resistance out west on Turtle Island against the Mount Polly mine disaster. But first, can you introduce yourself to listeners?
Canahus Pathki Risk West. Greetings, everybody out there listening. My name is Canahus Pathki. It means red woman. And I'm from the Sahuatmoc and the Tanaka Nation. People may know it as the Shuswap and Kootenays in so-called British Columbia. It's a vast area. Our territory is one of the biggest nations in the so-called province. And there's major industry right now that our nation is battling. And it's very urgent times with the mining and the pipelines and resource extraction coming in greater than they ever have before.
Mm-hmm. So you've been really active in the last few months against one of the biggest environmental disasters, acts of ecocide, really, in recent Canadian history, which was the Mount Polly mine disaster that happened on August 4th of this year. So can you tell us a little bit about the Mount Polly disaster and what have been some of your community's efforts in resistance since then?
The area of the Mount Polly disaster, Mount Polly Corporation is a gold and copper mine in Caribou country, they call it, within Sahuatmoc territory. And it's the area, the traditional place name for the area is Yuhnasen Chaimetqua. It's a very, very beautiful area. The name meaning the word Yucht, meaning when a woman gives birth, the birthing grounds of the salmon. How that lake spills into the rivers that nurture the rest of the lands. And Sen Chaimetqua means the biggest, like the better than great of all the Great Lakes. And they said there's no real way to translate just the magnitude of the beauty and how this massive water source has provided our people with water since the beginning. It's the Quesnel Lake is what it's called now, is the largest glacier fed lake in the world. It's deep. It's so deep. They said they can't even find the bottom. The farthest they got to was like 2,500 feet. And this is a beautiful area. And what happened on August 4th was, I think people are still just not even getting over the shock, or just barely getting over the shock of this massive catastrophe and what this means to our people, to our salmon, to our water, to our moose, to our deer, to our caribou, to everything that depends on that, the eagles and our whole connection with all of our relations. Like they say, the winged, like, you know, the feathered, the fin, the four-legged, the two-legged, like, the little creatures below and above the earth, all these things. And it's like stories from our elders, the connection between like all of this. So by coming and destroying an area, a watershed that so much life depends on, it's not just like, yeah, it could be land in the middle of nowhere. These are coming from pristine waters, from watersheds that flow into the Fraser River, and which provides 63% of the province population depend on that Fraser River and the watershed. And then that's the water. And then what about the salmon and all those indigenous communities all the way down to the ocean on that Fraser River that depend on that salmon?
So what exactly happened on November 4th? There was a tailings pond spill.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
On August 4th, there was a... they call it a tailings impoundment area, and they want us to stop calling it tailings pond because it doesn't give a visualization of what it is. But the tailings and the toxic mining wastes, and it's just the waste from the operation of the mine that are full of mercury and arsenic and lead and all these processing chemicals, selenium, copper, all these heavy metals and processing chemicals that were unleashed into the environment. And when that dam, the dam broke and the wall collapsed. And this, the wall of these tailings impoundment areas are massive. They're three telephone pole high. Mm. So you can imagine that around 4 or 5 kilometers wide. Wow. So it's a massive amount of area. And all of that spilled into Polly Lake, which is a glacier-fed lake, into Hazeltine Creek, and into Quesnel Lake, Quesnel River, and then the Fraser River watershed. And this area of Polly Lake is a beautiful lake, and Imperial Metals was applying for a permit to make Polly Lake into a tailings impoundment area 5 years ago. And now it is. That's what it became. It came a tailings impoundment with all of that unleashing, a size of a lake, unleashing into another lake and then flooding down Hazeltine Creek. There was all the footage that people saw on the news and everything of the water flowing that was down Hazeltine Creek. Mm-hmm. So it coated that whole creek with toxic sludge and sediment. And it was a 5-foot creek. And through that, just the pressure and the power that of that, all of that tailings liquid going down, plowed down whole entire old growth forest, massive trees, covered in sludge. But just the power of them just ripped trees right in half. Mm-hmm. And so all of that, the mining waste, including the trees that were, you know, like all that whole forest, like imagine how much trees that is, all flooded right into Quesnel Lake. And which is was expecting the second largest sockeye salmon spawning run coming through within the next month.
Mm-hmm. So since that happened, Imperial Metals, the company again that was responsible, has kind of said that they're engaged in a cleanup effort. But you've been out on the land and you've seen otherwise. So can you tell us like what's happening there with this so-called cleanup effort?
Well, 14 days after the disaster, we had nation discussion to talk about what our plan was about dealing with this Mount Polly disaster. After 14 days of just pretty well being in shock, and the elder said, no, you have to go up there. If we're going to be talking about it, you need to go up right there to the land. And so we did, and we went and lit a sacred fire. And the elders and the hereditary chief that was with us and the salmon chief was like, it's the women. The women have to light this fire. And upon lighting this fire with a group of very strong women, this fire turned into an encampment. And this encampment was like the epicenter for a crisis where there was no place for people to come together with ideas and knowledge and emotion and feeling about what happened and what we're going to do about it. And all that discussion happened around this fire. And workers came to tell us, to give us testimony about what actually happened and mm-hmm. that it was spilling over in May and that they got 5 warnings that they were dumping human waste from Greater Vancouver area, medical waste, and like crazy, absurd things that were coming out, and not just by one worker, but like countless people in the community start telling us more and more about this mine and saying that their mining practices and their management already was really, really negligent and that this could have been avoided. But neither the province, they don't have no monitors of all of this stuff. They don't have that. They're cutting all of that back. They don't have people enforcing it, all the warnings that they got. And so after this, we knew we had to take things into our own hands as our community and what we're going to do and how we're going to deal with that. So there's many scientists and mining experts and biologists and very knowledgeable, like knowledge keepers, elders, and everybody that have come together to come out with this report, like this report that is an impact assessment from the people. It's not a scientific report. It's not like, but it's like actual Indigenous people on the land, on the ground, monitoring our territory and giving our own impact of what a catastrophe like this happen could happen on our people. And our people went through trauma and are still going through trauma because these are accumulative effects. When you unleash like thousands of tons of these types of things into our watershed, it may not show up right now, a month, but 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, you know, 30 years, we know that all of these are accumulative effects that get absorbed into the food web. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of that food web, we end up digesting that. And the most impacted of mercury and such, we know, are the babies, are the women, and the women, the pregnant women, and the ones that are passing that on, because those type of heavy metals like mercury, they go from the woman's placenta into the baby. And that baby is born with it. It doesn't dilute. It goes on to their baby. So these are things that they're understanding about mercury poisoning. And we look at Grassy Narrows, just more closer by here, and they're dealing with the same mercury. So while we were camped out at Mount Polly, those Japanese doctors were at Grassy Narrows doing more blood and hair testing for that Metamoda, the mercury disease. Mm. And these are impacting indigenous peoples. And now they're unleashing that warfare on our people over there. If we let this happen at Mount Polly, and it gets swept under the rug, and then nobody's talking about it, and people are not outraged, then this is going to happen here. It's going to happen in every single community and across this so-called country, because mining is everywhere. And these Canadian mining companies are getting away with too much. They're going down to other territories and other countries, mm-hmm. and destroying other Indigenous people. And that's what we have to do, like, as our movement grows, is to unite all the nations. And that's what we have done with this Imperial Metals Mount Polly fight, is to unite with the Tahltan, who are also fighting against Imperial Metals.
So tell us a little bit more about that. You, after the Mount Polly mine disaster, you traveled up north, mm-hmm. To meet with other nations. I wanted to talk about the Tahltan Nation, where there's another Imperial Metals mine, the Red Chris mine, on their territory. So tell us about that visit and what came out of that.
So on August 8th, the Tahltan erected two blockades, and they blockaded Red Chris Mine Corporation's access roads into their mine site. That was 4 days after the disaster, and they maintained that blockade for the same amount of days as we were at Mount Polly, like 14 days. They manned those blockades and stopped Red Chris from going through. And they, again, when we went, those blockades were down because they needed to regroup within the community and educate all of the people about why Red Chris needs to be stopped. And so they pretty well said that this is life or death, like whether we're going to convince our people and the truth about Mount Polly. And that's what they asked, if we could come and share the truth about Mount Polly. So we brought our footage of actually going to Ground Zero, looking at the impact site, the report of talking to everybody that we can about mining disasters and the impacts that these certain chemicals have on our people. And the photos and the testimonies that we went up there and shared the stories of the people impacted. And so from then, the day after they reestablished their blockade, the elders and the people had enough evidence to know that they don't want Mount Polly. They don't want Mount Polly in their homelands, like 18 kilometers from their village of Iskut. Mm. And so they lit a sacred fire right on the entrance road to Red Chris, and they stopped all vehicles from coming in. Wow.
And then, of course, Imperial Metals tried to get a permanent injunction, mm-hmm. to have the blockade removed, and they failed at that. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. Well, the Imperial Metals was seeking that permanent injunction in a Supreme Court in Vancouver. And they do things so sneaky, and injunctions are being used against people everywhere and Indigenous people that are standing up for their territory and their rights. It's really unceded, unsurrendered lands where the province don't even have any jurisdiction to be doing this. So forcing Indigenous people into the court to defend themselves on protecting their territory. And for elders, it's very, very absurd to them to be having to prove to a foreign government that this is their land and they don't want mining to take place. It's really absurd because the whole Canadian legal system is based on a legal fiction, and they teach that in law school. And I hear that over and over from certain different lawyers, that it's based on a legal fiction that our land was empty and they can just come and assert their rule and law over the land.
Terra nullius. Uh-huh.
And then so when they gave us this injunction, they came and gave them pretty well 2 days to get down to Vancouver, which is pretty well impossible from then. But we happened to be down there in Vancouver at the time, like myself, Suhwatmukh, and all the way from the Tahltan. Then I learned that they named me on the injunction, and they had all their injunction, like their documents that they had with pictures and information about, like, oh, this is Kanahus was here involved with Mount Polly, and now she came up here, and you know, like there's a whole bunch of things that they're like trying to say about me on there. I'm a mother. I like care about the land, but they frame things and set it up so you look like a criminal, but you are a mother and you're speaking the truth. And these are the things that this legal system, you cannot have no win in this legal system. So we are forced into this way of defending ourselves at this point. Like that's why we're called the defendants. And, It's a really sad moment when people have to go face an arrest, you know. So like getting an injunction and enforcement order against the people to remove them from the blockade, but to them it's a sacred fire that they're protecting their land and upholding their laws, Tahltan laws, and their responsibilities. Like, so the Imperial Metals came with their high-priced lawyers and thinking that, okay, this is just the norm. Judges always rubber stamp it. Industries applying for injunction and enforcement order granted. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's what big corporations like Imperial Metals, they thought they were going to get that day. And it was upon the judge coming down with the order, because what we wanted to do was... we applied for a change of venue. Usually they don't give a change of venue either, but the judge granted that change of venue so that it could be in Terrace, which is, you know, a third of the way to Vancouver. So it's less travel for the elders to have to be able to travel to prove that they're not guilty of, you know?
Right.
So the judge ended up granting a temporary injunction against Imperial Metals. Imperial Metals is still seeking a permanent injunction, and it'll be heard in Terrace within this next little bit. And also, they never gave an automatic enforcement order. So they gave an enforcement order to be in place 6 days later. And so that's what happened. And Imperial Metals was pissed, you know, at the decision. And so... it gave a little bit more time for the community to be able to strategize on where do people want to go when we get injunctions. Like communities like Iskut, who've been served injunctions and enforcement orders before, like in 2005 when they fought against Royal Dutch Shell and getting them out of their sacred headwaters. They were successful in that. And But they had their elders get arrested. Mm. You know, like the elders got arrested, and many people wanted to get arrested in the community and said, like, no, if they're going to go, they could arrest me. But it was really the elders that said no. Like, as the elders will get arrested and stepped up to their responsibility. And they end up getting released, brought, and then released. But they had to, and there was more arrest that took place in other times when they stood up. Mm. So they're really aware of the whole injunction system. And it's a weapon by Canada. That's what an injunction is. It's like to displace Indigenous people from their land. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to create all this mayhem and all of this craziness by blockading. It's not just any Jane Doe or John Doe, like they said, that's coming to blockade the road. It's Indigenous people that are standing up for their territory, unceded, unsurrendered territory, and say, no, big industry is not welcome in our lands.
Mm-hmm. Let's actually talk a little bit about unceded, unsurrendered territory in so-called British Columbia, because I think it's a context that some of our listeners here in Montreal and in Quebec might not be familiar with, or in other people who live on treaty territory in other parts of Canada. So in pretty much all of BC, it's non-treaty territory, unsurrendered, as you said. Can you talk a little bit about that, mm-hmm. and, you know, how that, I guess, manifests itself with Indigenous resistance, mm-hmm. to colonialism, mm-hmm. in out west?
Well, I'd like to say, like, the last of the wild Indians, like, they're out there. Like, when we talk about unceded, unsurrendered lands, we talk about that there's been no treaty or purchase with Great Britain. Like, there has never been no treaty or purchase with Canada or British Columbia. And so with this in mind, we come from a area where we know this is our land. You know, we're raised into this mentality that we've never surrendered. We have never given in to the government. And so we're left with a very strong pride and acknowledge that this is our land, that we have responsibilities to this land. Our people say, yeah, we'll use rights in a legal term or in English language now, but really it's a responsibility. All of our stories in our way, all of our stories and our teachings that come in the form of stories, Siklep stories, have all of our laws of consensus and decision-making, our laws of the way that the woman conducts herself, the laws of relationships with the trees and the animals, the laws and original agreements. Like, these are all stories, and they may seem primitive to people, but they're far more advanced. Because we have, as Sahuatmung people, we created a society that had everything figured out. We were able to live with the earth and never destroy it. We were able to maintain clean water for tens and tens of thousands of years. Mm-hmm. We were able to, you know, maintain a healthy, healthy diet with just living off of the land and pure and unprocessed. We were able to, like, develop such an advanced society through making baskets and clothing out of tree bark that just biodegraded and everything back into the earth, our houses as well. Mm-hmm. Like, so all of this, all of these teachings that are in our teachings as Indigenous people have been raised in generations and generations of all of this vast knowledge. When you come into a territory that was powerful like this, but decimated some of our communities 100% with smallpox and different epidemics, mm-hmm. and biological warfare on our people. Like, it was proven that John Todd, who they name a mountain after in my territory, brought smallpox blankets to our people. This was war that was happening on our people. And at that time, when you talk about, 50 to 90% of your villages and your nation decimating, those are your storytellers. Those are your medicine men. Those are your midwives. Those are your advanced hunters and moccasin makers and basket weavers. And those are all those people that have those skills. Mm-hmm. And then you take them away from that and force them on Indian reservations and concentration camps when you had to get a permit from the white Indian agent to even leave there. And then you take all our children away and our babies away and you put them in residential school and you beat them for being Indian, for talking, and you rape them and you sexually molest them and you messed with them through trauma so bad. And then this is the remnants that is left. This is the resistance that is left, that we are backed into the corner and through so much warfare and trauma that our generation, my generation, is the first generation out of the Indian residential school system. And we're saying no more. Like, ya basta. Like, we're saying no more. We're not going to take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that's what leaves this resistance movement as such a fierce, fierce movement. And knowing that our lands have never been ceded or surrendered by our ancestors or us. And we have 100% very powerful fight and claim to our territory. And this is what forms the resistance movement. And 1990 is very important for the people, too, in so-called British Columbia, Indigenous people.
You mean 1990 with the Oka crisis?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and it was like an honor to meet some of the people there and talk to some of the people. Like yesterday at last night's event, and talking about this coming year being the 25-year anniversary and how that has inspired the people of so-called British Columbia, Indigenous peoples, and my people in particular. And it's a year, too, that the Native Youth Movement was sparked in Winnipeg. And this is really important for the resistance in BC as well, mm-hmm. is because it was Native Youth Movement after Gustafson Lake Uprising in 1995 that formed. And, you know, the actions that Native Youth Movement took inspired me and my involvement into this resistance movement, you know, occupying the BC Treaty offices in Vancouver, occupying Department of Fisheries and Oceans office because of their attack on Burnt Church, like, and then when we joined Native Youth Movement as younger, we took it to the land and start taking back land in our mountains, and building homes and everything out there, learning our ways and bringing young people out onto the territory, out of the cities and into the territories, off of the reservation and onto the territories, and saying, listening to what our elders were like, pretty well screaming at us, like, this is your land, go out and move on it. Mm. Don't get stuck on the Indian reserve. Like, that's just in our mind. Mm. That's just the imagination. They think they, you know. And so we know, and then when we get out there onto the territory, we get trespass notices, we get injunctions thrown on us. And then they don't want us to argue the title issue in there because we're defending ourselves as a criminal act. Mm-hmm. So the judges say that it's not a venue to speak on that issue. But when you represent yourself, you can start bringing these issues out and you're not muzzled by like the limitations of hiring a lawyer like what we did at Sun Peaks. But my grandpa says, never hire a lawyer, always represent yourself as an Indigenous person.
So just in the last year, I mean, I think it's been a really incredible year in terms of Indigenous resistance, because we saw, of course, out east, Elsipogtug, and the resistance against fracking out there in so-called New Brunswick, Mi'kmaq territory. And then all of the blockades, the direct actions that are happening out in the west, of course, in Sequamish territory, but also in Wet'suwet'en territory against the pipelines. There's new camps that are springing up now, like the Matty Lee camp. Maybe can you just reflect a little bit on that? Because we're seeing now more and more communities taking up direct action. And I'm wondering if you see, is this resistance spreading, or, you know, is there kind of a powerful network being forming, or?
Everything that you said is exactly true. I really believe that the energy and the power from 1990, from the Oka uprising here, it's like a growth. You start to build upon the resistance, that culture of resistance, and look on what does resistance really look like, and by putting a standard to like how far people are willing to go. And then from there, Gustavson Lake, and you know, like the Dudley George here in the Stony Point Park, and mm-hmm. there's like Oji Madzik here out of Toronto, like reclaiming back land, you know, like and in BC, we're looking at a bombardment or whatever of industry. So we have no other choice. We're getting backed into the corner, backed up in the corner, our last of our untouched territories, and we need to stop these from going through. So, yeah, we're in solidarity. We support each other in these movements, and it's really important. It's a big geographical area, like so-called BC is like Washington State, California, like Oregon and California mm-hmm. combined. So it's a vast area, and you're saying that that's all unceded, unsurrendered land. Pristine water, glacier water, salmon creeks that these pipelines infrastructure want to crisscross through. So, yes, there will continue to be more opposition to these pipelines. The Unist'ot'en camp of the Wet'suwet'en people, and there's another camp in the Wet'suwet'en territory. There's Mati Lee, which is north in the Gitxsan territory, and the Tahltan have their camps set up against the mining industry and stopping many other types of resource extraction from going through too. They're facing a big war up there right now because of the northern transmission line going, finally just making it up there. And it goes right up to Red Chris. And that's what mining companies have been waiting for, and exploration companies, is that northern transmission line getting up there. So it's really important for Indigenous people to show solidarity, but also non-Indigenous people. And if there's any skills, people may say like, oh, how can I help and everything? But everyone knows what skill they have. Offer that skill. If you can't offer skill, offer money so they have billions of dollars to fight us mm-hmm. and we're scrambling for pennies because people are working on this issue full time and nobody gets paid. You don't get paid for being on a blockade. That's your self-sacrifice. Mm. And that's what all these people and all these warriors are doing, is it's a lot of self-sacrifice. So by providing financial donations and having fundraisers in your communities, this is very, very helpful. And also good communications and skills and technical skills and being able to get the message out and spread the message. Tell 10 of your family, tell 10 of your friends about this issue, and that there is unceded territory. Start discussion. What does that mean? You know, mm-hmm. like, what does that mean to people? And so... Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to ask you about was you handed me this really nice flyer about a film that you're in. It's called Freedom Babies, and you said you were just premiering it down south of the colonial imaginary border in the Bay Area. But tell us about this film, Freedom Babies.
This film, it's made by my auntie Doreen Manuel. She's a filmmaker. And she said this is the reason why she started this film, if I could just say it real quick, is that she was looking at all these other films, Native films, that were being put out at the Native American film festivals and different Native film festivals around. And she starts saying, like, you know, people, and looking at me and my involvement in the movement and how I raise my children. And she was like, I need to do a story on you because people need to know that there's people like you. And so really, there's nothing really special about me, but just that I live as much as I can Indigenous way. And I have a traditional pit house with my family, and My children are not registered with the Canadian government, and they're not documented through any type of paper with the government. And they hold Indian names, no last names. That was a colonial last name. And we call them freedom babies. We call them freedom babies. So it's a video that hasn't, it's just been screening at film festivals so far, but I showed it to the students at, what university was I at?
McGill.
Yeah, and McGill University today. And every time I watch it, I'm inspired by my children because they're not registered. And they're the ones that sacrifice too, because they go without a lot. A lot of people, low-income people, know they depend on their child tax money every month. No, I don't get no child tax. I don't get none of the benefits. I can't go bring my kid to the Western doctor if I want, or dentist, or, you know, whatever benefits that status cards and registering your children have. So they're homeschooled, Indigenous Life School. They're a part of a life school program that many families are a part of. It's where the parents become the teachers and bring back our ways. It's a seasonal land-based experiential school program, and it's an advanced school program that's set up by Indigenous professors and real academics that are looking at how do we raise our children so that they can have these brilliant minds like our ancestors, and how they have the skills to be able to survive. If we left them out in the bush in the middle of the winter, they could build a winter shelter and survive. Huh. And they know how to light a fire without a lighter. Like, so these types of things, you're able to survive. People go to school, they work their whole life to get a house and maybe a vehicle and some land and, you know, clothing and, you know, basic needs. Their whole life they'll work and commit to that. But if we could just teach our children how to build their own house, how to provide themselves with their own food, how to make their own clothing, and how to, you know, have land and be by clean water, then we could raise a society of children and young warriors that way, then in 10, 20 years, we're going to have a powerful, powerful nation.
So the website for the film is freedombabies2014.com. Again, I've been speaking with Kanahus Manuel, an inspiring freedom fighter from Mountain Suquamish Territory, so-called BC. Lastly, if people want to get more information on the resistance to Imperial Metals, the Mount Polly mine disaster, where can people find more information?
Well, we have like a sort of long name, but it's the Yuknesen Chaimatgoit Camp on Facebook. And you could just type in Y-U-C-T and Yucht, and everything should pop up, because there's no other Yucht that I know. But Yuknesen Chaimetgua, and also imperialnomore@gmail.com. We have information if you want to get involved, if you want to hold a fundraiser, if you want to, you know, just touch base and get more information. That's the easiest way, is just to get in touch with me. I could send you links. It's called imperialnomore@gmail.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Kanahus.
Thank you.